plan to reduce childhood obesity. I'll run through a few remarks and we'll drill. He'll have a few things to say and ask the same questions on that, and we'll just move on to the rest of the script and go from there. But as you know, the government is working hard to keep New Zealanders healthy. We're investing nearly $16 billion a year into health, more than ever before. We've introduced free doctor's visits for children under 13, reduced cancer treatment waiting times, increased elective surgery, and improving screening and disease prevention. Today we're announcing a plan to tackle obesity, starting with children. New Zealand has the third highest rate of adult obesity amongst OECD countries. 10% of children aged between 2 and 14, and over a million New Zealanders are obese. There's no single solution to fix obesity, so we have developed a range of initiatives across government, private sectors, families and schools. The plan we're announcing today focuses on children because that's where the evidence shows we can make the most difference. At the core of the plan is a new child obesity health target. Last year, 1,400 children who received before school checks were referred for obesity related support. We expect that number to grow to over 4,000 by December 2017. We want to ensure those children and their families get the support they need, so we set a target. We want to see 95% of children identified in the before school check as being obese referred to a health professional for an assessment by December 2017. This will allow them to access all the support they need, from family and nutritional advice to help with activity and lifestyle changes that might be required. The earlier we can help educate young people about healthy living, the better chance we have of them adopting healthier lifestyles. We know how important it is to encourage people to be active, so we're expanding initiatives targeted at children at Kiwi Sport and sport and education programs in schools. Community programs such as Healthy Families will also continue to be rolled out across the country. We're also working with the food industry on the role they can play, including appropriate advertising targeting children and food labelling. Childhood obesity is a serious issue and means some of our kids could end up having shorter lives than their parents. I'm confident the range of measures announced today will go some way to improving health of our young people. I'll hand over to Jonathan, so he'll make a few remarks, take the questions and we'll go from there.
Thanks very much, Prime Minister. So, good afternoon everybody. Look, next year, obesity is going to overtake tobacco as our largest preventable health risk. So this is obviously something we need concerted government action on. Prime Minister's been through the statistics. In terms of children, you know, 1 in 10 New Zealand kids are obese, but much higher in our Maori and Pacific Island communities. So 15% of Maori children, 25% of Pacifica children are obese. So what we've come up here with is a comprehensive package. I've been working with my ministerial colleagues, also with officials, obviously in my sport and health portfolios, but also across education, food safety, MSD, to come up with a range of initiatives which we think will make a real difference. The thing about this package is it follows a whole life course approach, so it's looking at the factors affecting obesity from the time of conception through those early childhood years right up to the age of 18. It's evidence-based. We've had input from an expert advisory group. Boyd Swinburne has been on that group. We've also had Sir Peter Gluckman, who's chairing the WHO Commission on Obesity. I've been talking to him very regularly. So at the heart of the package is the target, which the Prime Minister spoke about there. We have six health targets. This is going to replace the heart check and diabetes target, but what it signals is that this is a very, very important area for the government. And when you look at the effect those six health targets have had, they've directed action and they've delivered some real results over time, and we think this will be the case with this package as well. In terms of the package as a whole, we have 22 initiatives, 11 of them are new, 7 are expanded initiatives, and 4 are initiatives that are already underway. Now, they are in 3 different categories. There are targeted initiatives at those who are already obese, there's initiatives for those at real risk of becoming obese, and there are broad population-based strategies. And this package will be implemented in a variety of settings. So the health setting is going to be very important, the education setting, there'll be broad public information put out there, and also will be working with industry. So a couple of issues in the package which I'd like to touch on. We are not going to be implementing a sugar tax. There's often a lot of confusion about what a sugar tax actually is. That would be a tax on sugar in every type of food sold in New Zealand, and that is unworkable. There has been debate about tax on soft drinks. At the moment, the evidence on that is inconclusive. It's been implemented in Mexico, but there's been no direct causation shown with decreasing rates of obesity. There's only preliminary sales data. We've looked at food in schools, and we will be working very closely with schools. I've requested that Aero goes and gives us a report on food and nutrition across the education system. And, you know, when you look at it, obesity varies in terms of the levels of prevalence in different schools, and that's often based on the socioeconomic background of the kids going to those schools. So it's a different problem in different communities in different parts of the country. But we think the key here is going to be getting into those schools where there really are difficulties and making sure that we've got programs that can help us intervene successfully. The last part is that industry is a big part of the solution. We've got to make sure that they are fully engaged. One of the first things that I did was call industry together with health officials to make sure that they understood the extent of the issue. And there are some initiatives underway, but we want to work much more closely with them in the coming months. A very interesting part of the package will be bringing sport and health together. We've gone out and approached five high-profile New Zealand sports stars who are going to appear in promotional activity in a high-profile advertising campaign, which is going to be launched later next month. So when you put this package together, it's a comprehensive set of interventions. It's based around a target, and it's going to be delivered in a wide range of settings. It's a very important initiative for New Zealand kids, and this is going to mean that the future generation of New Zealanders hopefully are not going to suffer from the diseases most closely associated with obesity. So thank you very much. Very happy to take any questions you might have.
Dr. Coleman, you met with industry when?
Oh, health officials would have met with industry probably 6 months ago.
You met with them?
I addressed them via a teleconference to outline my vision for this obesity package.
When was that?
I can give you the exact date, haven't got it off the top of my head, probably 6 months ago.
You said that sugary evidence is inconclusive, that sugary drinks cause obesity.
That's correct. Yep, so we've looked at the evidence.
Or did you say that evidence is inconclusive that sugary drinks result, or that a sugar tax would affect them?
So if you tax soft drinks, they've done some work in Mexico on this, they had a 9% tax. That showed a decrease in sales, but they weren't clear if that was just a correlation or if there was direct causation. So there's some work being done at Waikato University, also University of North Carolina, which is going to report later in 2017. So the evidence at the moment is definitely inconclusive, and there's a whole lot of factors in that Mexican case which I could take you through, but you know, that is definitely the case. The other point about sugar tax is, in terms of disability-adjusted life years saved, it's actually relatively low compared to some of these other interventions. So we've gone for the most effective suite of interventions.
If it becomes conclusive, if the evidence from Waikato University shows it will make a difference, will you implement it?
We'll always be open-minded about considering the evidence, but for the time being, we're not doing a tax on soft drinks.
Will you regulate the ability to sell and prices of soft drinks either?
Well, no, we won't.
What commitment?
What's that? Well, when you look at the elasticity of demand, I mean, it would be pretty difficult to say at what level increasing the cost of the soft drink would actually have an effect on obesity. And so that's the key. And if you look at this package, in the end, it's very closely based on the evidence as it is at this time.
Soft drink is also destroying children's teeth, is it not? And is there conclusive evidence that it's destroying children's teeth?
Well, look, soft drink, obviously, taken in excessive amounts, is not good. And one of the things the DHBs has actually done, they've taken the soft drinks out of DHBs, so they're not for sale here any longer. That doesn't mean a child shouldn't have an occasional soft drink. But getting back to the central point, there's no evidence that a tax on soft drinks would actually affect obesity at this point, right? So the evidence is being put together, and assessed and reported back
in 2007.
So I think we've covered that pretty thoroughly.
You're targeting pregnant women, so you're targeting pregnant women as part of this. What's your issue there? And are they being unfairly targeted?
No. So the story with pregnant women is at that time of life, it's a time when people are prepared to modify behaviour. There's also a risk during pregnancy around gestational, so that's during pregnancy, diabetes, mellitus. And the hard drive for a human being, a lot of it is set in that perinatal period. And the evidence clearly shows that if a mother has gestational diabetes, there's a higher likelihood that that child she gives birth to will go on to become obese in the long term. So what we're doing here, we're standardising the testing of pregnant women for diabetes mellitus, and we're making sure that they have access to the care and the resources they need. That's one of 22 initiatives, but it's a very important one. So it's not placing an onus on women in any way at all, but it's saying, look, we've got to do the testing, and if they are at risk or have developed it, we've got to make sure we've got the interventions available to support
them. Who are the sports stars in your life?
So there's five very high-profile sports stars, but we're not going to announce those today until we actually launch the package, which will be in November.
Just what commitments do you have from the advertising industry or the food industry about advertising?
So what we're doing, the ASA is going to prioritise a review of the advertising code as it applies to children. We're also going to have independent monitoring of that code, and already industry is taking some initiatives off their own bat around things like formulations, salt and fat content. So we're going to continue to work with them, but I mean they realise that in terms of remaining viable as businesses in the long term, it's going to be pretty important that they give consumers what they want, and consumers want healthier and better formulations.
But if they committed not to target children, I mean, what is the actual scope of what they said that they would do that they are, that they're doing now?
So in terms of their targeting, if you look at television advertising, actually there's a limited amount of television advertising during children's viewing hours that targets children. But what we're going to do is make sure that we've got that independent review of the code, and also independent monitoring is one of the things that Peter Blackman was very clear that needed to be added into the regime.
There's a lot of talk of targets and guidelines, but what's the actual tangible action? What are people actually going to see?
Well, if you go through those 22 actions, there's a lot there. But, I mean, if you look at what's happening, for instance, in the sport and education sector, so there's going to be, through the Play.Sport program, boosting up of PE resources in schools. So we're starting that in two specific clusters, one in Wainuiomata, one in Waitakere, where we will have PE advisors working with schools to try and build up the capability and capacity around PE teaching. So that would be one very specific example. There's also a redirection of Kiwi Sport resources to high-risk groups in Auckland. So, there's a full range of things there. I believe you've got the information package, but there's some very tangible interventions.
Just looking at the ERO food and schools side of things, will that be the ERO going to each school and assessing things, or will it be a sort of, in the first instance, an overarching kind of review?
So that still has to be scoped out. I asked officials early on to tell me which schools had healthy eating programs and which didn't, and they didn't actually have that info. So I'm very keen to actually get that picture so we know which ones we have to intervene with. ERO are going to look more broadly at nutrition and physical activity and the state of that, but I'm interested in what's happening in some of those individual schools.
So there will be a kind of, for want of a better description, a stock take of which schools have healthy eating and which schools...
That's what we're moving towards, but we've still got to write up the terms of reference.
The threshold for obesity is obviously, it is often being criticised.
Yeah.
That it's, people might be overweight, but they're not obese, and yet they're considered the yardstick as being obese.
Yeah. Well, on a population basis, it actually works. So BMI over 25 is considered overweight. This is for adults, and over 30 is obese. Now, you can take the All Blacks. They're all going to have BMIs that technically might make them look obese. But so taking the individual, it probably doesn't work. But if you look at large population groups, the science and the evidence does support it.
Why haven't you required the food industry to lower the amount of sugar and high fat? the products they put in their food?
We need to talk to them about that over time, but I mean, they're very aware of the public pressure around that. And one of the very key things that we've brought in recently is the Health Star rating. So people are going to have very clearly visible descriptions in, you know, plain English through the star rating on packaged food. Now, it's voluntary initially, but I think you find, you know, there's 200 or 300 products on the shelves already that have it. It's not going to be launched officially till next March, and I think you're going to find there's more and more.
Do you think, though, that there is too much sugar in food?
Well, look, in some foods there's too much sugar, you know, there's no question about it, but I think you'll find over time that they will want to respond to consumer demand to bring that down.
Why wait for consumer demand when you're saying you know that there's a problem?
Well, we're not going to regulate the amount of sugar in food, but I think it's very important that there's clear information that people can understand about the amount of sugar in
food.
Why
aren't you going to regulate the amount of sugar in food? We know that sugar is killing people. We know it causes obesity. We know that it inconclusively kills children and destroys their teeth. Why are we not regulating the amount of sugar?
Because there's lots and lots of things we could regulate, but in the end, regulation won't work in that space.
Sugar is almost like smoking. I mean, it is almost...
No, well, it's not. Actually, that's a very good point. It's not. So, look, some sugar is fine for you. No cigarette is good for you. Anyway, any more questions?
Is it a no-brainer to get soft drinks out?
Sorry, can you just speak up?
Is it not a no-brainer to at least get soft drinks out of schools? Isn't that quite a...
Well, look, so Coca-Cola, Amatil and Food Corps have pledged and have already done this, taken soft drinks out of schools. So there are some independent distributors who are still supplying schools, but they are not supplying the schools directly. No. So I think over time it would be a good thing to see soft drinks out of schools. That doesn't mean that on a special occasion like, you know, a school barbecue or a fundraiser, kids shouldn't be allowed to drink Coke. But on a daily basis, you know, we want to see healthier options. And very importantly, through education, people making healthier choices, not only about what they feed their kids, but ultimately the kids wanting to take those healthy choices.
Jonathan, most cereals in supermarkets contain 17, 18 28%.
We're not going to regulate them. Oh, I think we've covered that.
What consideration did you give to programs like UK Healthy Start, where particularly with lower socioeconomic families who need help, they get vouchers for healthy foods?
Yep. So we didn't look at vouchers. We placed the emphasis on education, also access to physical activity, and making sure that the information is available through the life course, 0 to 18. So, no, we haven't considered vouchers. And actually, what's that? Well, there's many different ways you could deliver this, but I don't actually think giving people vouchers in the end is going to change their attitudes to food. So, you know, yep, they might go and use that, but I mean, that would be a very, you know, prescriptive way for the state to intervene, and, you know, that doesn't philosophically align with where we're at. And I don't think you'd find, well, maybe the Green Party might want to do it, but I very much doubt anyone else in Parliament would want to give people vouchers specifically, describing what they've got to eat.
Similar sort of arguments made by virtue of the fact that, you know, if a four-year-old is considered obese and needs intervention, the whole family needs once-over. Is that not?
Now, that is part of it, actually. So at the before-school check, we're saying 95% of those children found to be obese will be referred for that specialist intervention, and it will be a whole-of-family intervention. So it will be, but food vouchers are not going to be
National rule book rules Coleman. About food and tuck shops, one of the in the first term. So has that made it worse? schools couldn't actually sell unhealthy food. That was repealed by National, so hasn't this made childhood worse?
The fact is, we did do that. We felt that you know, if you've got the dairy outside the school selling Coke, actually, that's not going to stop having that guideline. It's not going to stop a child going and buying the Coke. So, I mean, we're looking at more long-term approaches. In the end, you've got to make people want to change, and you've got to make them understand. You know, what nutrition is about, and that's about education and changing habits.
So, I don't think that policy made the situation for children worse?
Well, despite having that policy, children were still getting bigger, so it wasn't, delivering a silver bullet for obesity. And that's one of the points, you know, there is no single answer to this
I hosted Australian Prime Minister Turnbull in Auckland over the weekend. Prime Minister Turnbull made a deliberate choice to make New Zealand his first overseas destination and expressed his commitment to deepening bilateral ties. We had a wide-ranging discussion covering a number of issues such as trade, New Zealand-Australian economies, the rights of New Zealanders in Australia, the situation in Iraq, and various other local and international matters. On the issue of deportations, I made it clear I felt a degree of compassion was needed for those New Zealanders who are not high risk and have a long-term community of interest in Australia. Mr Turnbull acknowledged the appeal process needs to take place much faster and has agreed to devote more resources to ensure that happens. This should help reduce the number of New Zealanders being placed in detention centres and give them much more certainty about their future. We also agreed that our respective immigration ministers will review their arrangements and ensure the appeal process has been conducted in the most efficient and compassionate way. Prime Minister Turnbull and I will discuss the issue further at our annual leaders' talks in Australia earlier next year. In the House this week, we look to advance a number of second readings and committee stages on the order paper, including the Organised Crime and Anti-Corruption Legislation Bill and the Waitangi National Trust Board Amendment Bill. In terms of my activities, I'm in Wellington tomorrow and on Wednesday as usual. I'm in New Plymouth on Thursday, Hawke's Bay on Friday. As you know, I'll be travelling to Marrakesh, Brussels and London, so there'll be no post-cabinet press conference next week.
Prime Minister, should New Zealanders be detained on Christmas Island?
My preference is no. I don't think New Zealanders should be going to detention centres, and what we've really agreed over the weekend is, one, that process should be eliminated because effectively any New Zealander is now free to come home and process their individual case from New Zealand. So that's the first point. Secondly, there'll be much more resource put into the sort of bow wave of people that are there because of the threshold change, and that will allow the process to be speeded up, so again that process will happen much more quickly. But as a personal preference, I would prefer New Zealand's answer there.
Sorry, did you say that you agreed at the weekend that process wouldn't go on any further?
Well, what we agreed was that A, more resources would go and sort of be speeded up a lot more quickly. Secondly, as a matter of principle going forward, because we're just dealing with the bow wave, but over time when there's a normalised sample, all of these will be dealt with before the end of the sentence, so there won't be an issue where people are going through the appeal process. And thirdly, they made a change, it's not their law but their policy, to ensure that people were free to come home. In fact, they should come home, be in New Zealand and work through the appeal process. They're not disadvantaged by this.
So Christmas Island in particular, do you think, you know, there's a lot of detention centres in Australia, but Christmas Island in particular, do you think New Zealanders should be there like those sort of 50-odd guys are right now?
Well, my preference is no, and that's because many of these people have families and they're further away from those families.
So did you ask Malcolm Turnbull why the Kiwis are going all the way up to Christmas Island?
Yeah, and he's got a range of views about why they're being sent there. I'll need to check with my office whether I'm able to give you that information or not.
But you specifically asked him about Christmas Island?
Specifically, yeah.
You were worried about the thresholds as well. Was there any discussion about that? No movement, obviously, but what did he say about that threshold?
Well, the main issues what we're concerned about, I mean, ideally we'd like to go back to the old law, but the point is that law was supported by all sides of the Parliament in Australia. And so that's a very difficult thing to change. His main argument is that in terms of the issues around community of interest, length of time, severity of sentence, they are covered off through an appeals process. And the broad indication so far is about a third of people who appeal are actually having their visas reinstated.
And is that since December? So that third?
Since the new process.
Since the new process. Do you know how many people roughly that would be?
I do, but we agree we wouldn't talk about that number today.
Doesn't that just show that actually the policy is draconian and that when the Australian government actually look at it, they're like, oh, well, actually, you're fine, you can stay?
Well, they've taken this blanket view of saying at 12-month sentence or more, your visa is revoked and it's a blanket policy. But as you say, that doesn't necessarily reflect that there shouldn't be a reason why someone might be able to stay in Australia, for instance, have been there a very long time. They might have had multiple sentences that add up to 12 months, all of those kinds of factors. So hopefully with the body of knowledge that they're now building up and the commitment that he gave us in the weekend, that he'll be reaffirming the fact that they should be taking a view of looking very closely at those factors, that at least some New Zealanders who are in this category will be able to stay in Australia.
What about the people in Christmas Island? I mean, what were you told about how long they're going to be there? I mean, one of the things that they told us is the lack of information. They don't know how long they're going to be there, what the process is. I mean, what did he tell you about how those people would be treated from here on in?
So his main argument is those people should today ask to come back to New Zealand. They'll be immediately sent back.
What if they don't have the resources or the ability to do that? I mean, not everyone's going to be able to. I mean, we heard about the person who was dropped at the airport with $200.
Yep.
I mean, is that realistic for every single person in Christmas Island?
Well, realistically, yes. Then they can come back to New Zealand and then we'll deal with the situation back here. We have a legal responsibility to do that.
So,
is the New Zealand consulate
40...
geared up for dealing with all those inquiries if they start getting flooded in now? Or we've heard stories of people who aren't getting responses at all.
I would have thought so. I mean, in terms of the number of people in detention centres, I think it's around about 200, isn't it, from memory? There's about 50 on Christmas Island, so yeah, we can cope with that. I mean, in the end, his argument is, you will not be disadvantaged if you come back and have your application to have an appeal heard jeopardised because you're in New Zealand. Now, some of those people might take the view, look, out of sight, out of mind, and therefore might not want to come back. That might be the perception they have, but his argument is it makes no difference. And he's reiterated that point to Peter Dutton. He had a couple of conversations with Dutton when he was in New Zealand.
Are you seriously suggesting that the answer to deportations is to agree to be deported or to agree to go anyway?
Well, the point is that if your appeal is going to be upheld, there's two ways you can go through an appeal. One is that they listen to all the facts, they've got together all the facts, and on the balance of those facts, the minister agrees to an appeal and therefore says, yep, we'll reinstate your visa, that's one way. And if that fails, your second option is to go to the High Court. And his point is that whether the minister is considering the facts of your case from you sitting in Christmas Island or you sitting in Christchurch for one argument, it's irrelevant from the minister's point of view. It'll be on the facts of what you have done and what your long-term association with Australia is, not where you're currently located.
Did he actually say, Prime Minister, if a person in Christmas Island asks to be sent back, like tomorrow, they can come back with, and they can go back, come back right away?
All of them, yeah.
Do you think that a New Zealand politician who wants to visit New Zealand citizens inside an immigration detention centre should be able to visit them?
Well, I don't know the law in Australia, so I don't know what the access rights are there. I mean, in the end, if it's probably more a political stunt than a real effort to do something. But if Kelvin Davis has a serious argument about it, he should probably go down to Canberra and see his mates in the Labor Party there because they voted for this policy.
Do you think Kelvin Davis is right when he says that these detention centres are like prisons?
Well, on one hand, he's saying he can't get in, so he can't comment. On the other hand, he's commenting about what they're like. Both statements come.
So who would pay for the flights in that instance where a New Zealander says, I want to go home?
I don't know exactly, but imagine Australia, because they probably pay the deportation costs under anyone that goes home.
Then who pays if they want to go back, if they win that appeal and they go back to Australia?
I don't know the answer to that, but I mean, in the scheme of things, if these detention centres are as bad as people say they are, then that's probably the least of their problems, isn't it? I mean, if they're potentially going to be in a place for a period of time, which is very unpleasant, one would argue, I would have thought they'd be better to come back to New Zealand. We then have to deal with that situation, including that will be probably welfare support, it'll be wraparound support through the likes of PARS and others.
Has Cabinet discussed putting any extra resources in for those services, given we are seeing more people? I know we've asked this, but
So Corrections have agreed with PARS. I think at the moment they get $1.3 million a year, and they're going to receive an extra $100,000 grant to deal with the issues they're having to deal with at the moment. I think they're comfortable with that.
So in terms of Christmas Island, the president of the shire up there, who is effectively the mayor, for want of a better description, has told us that he can see no reason why the Kiwis are up there other than to separate them from their families and break them and force them into coming back to New Zealand. He sees it as a, basically, to use his terms, a bullying tactic by the Australian government.
Yeah, and that's not the version of events I got from Malcolm Turnbull over the weekend.
So what did Malcolm Turnbull tell you? Why?
Well, there are a number of reasons, but one of them was around behaviour of the people involved. They've been in other, in some cases, other detention centres.
So the ones that are worse behaved?
Well, I think some of them have been in other detention centres than being in other detention centres.
So what, Australia's punishing?
No, not punishing them, they're separating them from some other people.
Were you disappointed that you couldn't make more?
I don't have all the details on.
But I mean, do you want to find it? Because
it's not that I don't want to find out. I just accept people at their word if that's what they tell me.
Do you accept that it's legal for Australia to send New Zealanders to prison asylum in these circumstances? At international law?
Well, the law, as I understand, is they're free to come back to New Zealand. That's what Malcolm Turnbull's version of this.
Were you disappointed with basically only being able to really get a promise of compassion from Malcolm Turnbull, not actually getting any change to the policy, especially the rhetoric about New Zealand and Australia and how close we are?
No, I don't think it's totally right. I mean, as I pointed out in the morning media, I mean, the Australian media have reported it as Turnbull softening and the New Zealand media reported there's no change. So, like everything in life, it depends on how you look at it. But the point being that our main arguments are not about deportation per se, because New Zealand deports people. There are really two issues, as I said. One is around the use of detention centres. Notwithstanding, in the past, people in Australia have been sent to detention centres. It's just that there's a lot more people, and the threshold was a lot higher, so it wasn't in the focus of everyone's attention, if you like. So the main point there is we can eliminate that because they can come home. Now, they may not want to come home, and they may argue their families over there, and they might have a variety of other reasons, but they are free to come home and have all of their appeal processed. Secondly, he did give us a commitment for a lot more resources to speed up that process, and I accept him as word he's doing that. And the third thing is, and the bigger issue if you put detention centres to one side, is what about people who, you know, realistically, even though they fit the criteria of the law as passed by their parliament, it doesn't seem fair that they come back to New Zealand. They have family there, the crimes aren't that serious, they've been there for a long period of time. Those people look to us to be winning on appeal.
So you're happy with the basic policy?
No, I prefer the policy was the old policy, mirroring what we had in New Zealand, but I can't stop them doing that. And that policy was voted on by both sides of the parliament in Australia.
So Prime Minister, did the free to come home side of things, did that exist for your meeting with Malcolm Turnbull? Is that something new that he's...
It changed about a week ago, and it wasn't in terms of changing the laws, it was explained to me, it was changed in terms of part of the policy.
Is that Christmas Island or any detention centres?
Any detention centre.
Just another issue, economic confidence is up in the latest one news poll.
Well, I think if you go back a few months ago, there was quite a lot of negativity about falling dairy prices, and of course in the last sort of couple of months you've seen those dairy prices rising. You know, you continue to see strong economic activity in the services sector. You've seen the exchange rate coming off, so that's been a bit more competitive on the export side. And probably a settling down of the financial markets. You had a lot of concern about what was happening in China. Now, some of those issues are still there, but I think New Zealanders are just sort of feeling a bit more confident about what they see.
House prices aren't, though, are they? And a couple of months ago, you and I think Bill English were saying, you know, you felt things were cooling off. They're not.
I don't know. It's very mixed. I accept that the data in Auckland shows that they continue to rise. That's what we looked at about a week ago. In Christchurch, certainly the supply is on top of demand. I mean, rents are falling there. House prices have definitely stabilised, probably coming down a little bit. Anecdotally, we are hearing in Auckland, I've had a number of major real estate companies telling me that their own activity is down. Now, I know that didn't reflect the price increases that you saw in the most recent data that was released, but quite a number of them have said to me there's just a lot more houses being passed in, less people at auction, things are cooling down, their view.
And right. National's still steady, why do you think that is? There's just no change really?
Oh, look, I think firstly, we've had a good sort of month or so. TPP's been an important thing for New Zealand. It will open New Zealand up for a much greater access to some huge international markets. I think people could see from the pictures they saw across their TV sets about the work that we're doing in Iraq. The Kermadex, I think, was a very important environmental announcement from the government's perspective. I think the work we're doing on the Security Council has been highlighted, and of course the government's books are back in surplus. So I think just generally we look to, in my view, to be finishing the year quite strong. And I think in Labor's case, you know, they're a year on now under Andrew Little. He is extremely negative, and that's his prerogative if he wants to be. But actually, New Zealanders want solutions. They don't just necessarily want someone being opposed to things for the sake of it. And I think his numbers are not going to improve unless he starts offering alternatives about a better way forward for New Zealand. Because, yes, of course, the role of the opposition is to oppose things, but not just oppose them for the sake of it. At the end of the day, they've had so many positions on TPP, and the truth is that shows that they continue to be immensely divided as a political party. And as I said last week, you know, if they continue to oppose something like TPP, which is overwhelmingly beneficial to New Zealand, it speaks volumes about the Labour Party, not the quality of that particular trade deal.
What conclusions did you and Mr Turnbull reach when you were discussing both the economy and trade?
Well, we think there are more things we can do together, and on trade, both of us are going to be working towards a free trade agreement with the European Union. You know, he is very economically focused, as you'd expect given his background, and can see some quite significant challenges for Australia. Quite interested in what the policy prescription's been over here in New Zealand, and keen to work on some initiatives together. So, yeah, I mean, look, outside of the deportation issues and the other issues around rights of New Zealanders, the other half of the conversation was really around economic issues and where we see some opportunities.
Where does he see the Australian economy going in the next 6 months?
Oh, I think he sees challenges. I mean, they, you know, in the week that we announced a surplus, they announced a fairly sizable deficit in Australia. So you can see those challenges. And New Zealand fundamentally, I think, is actually more competitive than Australia. Competitive because of our labour markets, arguably better trade access. You know, our planning laws, we only have one house. They have a number of different issues which hold them back a bit. So, yeah, I think certain aspects is probably jealous of the policy settings in New Zealand.
Promise, whatever happened to the deal where New Zealand would take 150 refugees from Australia within our quota?
Yep, so every year we offer that to them. And so far, every year they've rejected taking that up. It's on the table. So this year, when they rejected taking that up, we agreed to take 150 Syrian refugees in their place.
The Sydney Morning Herald is reporting that Betty Colt is due to be deported.
Sorry, who?
Betty Colt. It's her pseudonym. She was done for living in an incestuous community over there and was done for trying to kidnap her children out of care.
Right, I'm sorry, I just don't know the details of that case.
I don't know if you've been notified.
No.
Prime Minister, so just again on the Christmas Island issue, what is your message to the guys in there who are saying, John Key, help us? What do you say?
Well, I think the simple message would be, you know, I don't want New Zealanders in Christmas Island. I think they should come home to New Zealand and we'll deal with the application, the processing of their appeals from New Zealand.
Yeah. Have you considered sending the plane up to pick them up?
No.
Why not? Do you really want them back?
Have you seen the latest US or UMR poll on the flag?
I have.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, of course there's a big battle if we're ultimately going to change the flag. I think what it shows is there's a high degree of support around the Kyle Lockwood designs. But I wouldn't take too much out of the actual overall numbers yet. I mean, ultimately when the country decides what the alternative is to the current New Zealand flag, then I think that will crystallise some thinking. I think you'll see a fair bit of activity around imagery of what a new flag might look like and a more intensified debate. Doesn't mean it's going to be an easy thing to change the flag, but trying to change the flag through a public referendum process is always going to be challenging. But I think it's a long way to the finishing line before we see exactly how New Zealanders vote.
It's a long way off, isn't it? It's a long way compared to the current flag. It doesn't even come close to beating anything. It's like 36 or to 64.
Yeah, but you're looking at them as individuals, and once you keep them consolidated down to one, you might see people who were voting in that sample for Red Peak or one of the other Kyle Lockwood's ones or the Corrie falling in and saying, these are what the numbers look like. Also depends who turns out, who votes. There's a lot of different factors.
Are you pleased to see trees going back on
1-3-0? Yep, that's always good. That's the trees. I'm exactly following, but yeah, I'm sure it's the case.
The report on Mount Eden Prison is due out at the end of this month, so next week. Do you know if that's still is scheduled to come out as planned? And what have you heard about what's actually in that and what they've uncovered?
I've only had a very brief sort of piece of advice that the report's on track, and not a conclusive amount of comment in it that would want me to make public comment about it.
Would you consider changing New Zealand laws for visas for Australians to make them just as harsh? I mean, there seems to be a bit of community support.
I don't think we should go down the retaliation route. I just don't think that takes us anywhere. I don't think it's who we are as a country. We accept a lot of Australians over here, just like Australia accepts a lot of Kiwis, and for the most part, they're highly value-added to our country. So, you know, we have deportation rules that mean if you commit a crime within the first 10 years that's serious enough, we'll deport you outside that. We keep you in New Zealand. Personally, I think those settings are in the right place, and kind of, you know, if we were to ultimately go and do that, we'd be doing a retaliation on the basis of Australian policy, not on what we think is right, and I don't think two wrongs make a right.
Is your understanding that more New Zealanders are going to be sent to Christmas Island, or that they are going to
stop? Did I give any advice on them? Sorry.
Did you ask him if he would stop sending New Zealanders to Christmas Island?
Any advice on them, sorry.
Prime Minister, the Chief Ombudsman said at the weekend that comments you made about the OAA process last year were cavalier. How do you respond to that?
Look, I sort of reject her comments. There's never ever been any discussion between her office and mine at any level on any concerns she might have. And to be frank, actually, our office not only abides by the law, but it tries to do so, you know, scrupulously and within the spirit of the law.
So has the Ombudsman's office spoken to your office as part of the review they're doing?
She's never done that.
Just quickly,
there's a review, she might have done the review, but nothing in terms of the comments she made at the weekend.
Have you got a message to the All Blacks?
Yeah, I mean, we're very proud of them. I think they've displayed over the weekend just how strong a side they are. But, you know, one of the amazing things about that All Black team and the management of that All Black side is that they've done a great job over the last decade, actually, of recognising that when it comes to World Cups, you know, every game's important, don't get too far ahead of yourself. I think they've done a great job of actually being ambassadors for New Zealand. And, you know, their outreach campaign, the way they work with schools, all the things they've done could be contrasted with other sides that don't do that as well. So, look, they're a great side on and off the field. Obviously, we're desperate to help beat South Africa and we'll see who they meet in the final.
Could you finalise the details of your bet with Malcolm Turnbull on?
It's a tie. We're tied, but they've got to get in the final. You and I, we reckon we'll be playing Argentina, but we'll wait and see. Okay, cool. Thank you.